Lecture 24. Where have the Etruscans gone?
The 20th century English author, D.H. Lawrence, wrote a book called Etruscan Places, Travels Through Forgotten Italy, in which he concluded, the Italian people of today is on the whole not Italic in that Roman sense, but much more near to the Etruscan. He was speaking culturally, but his conclusion could equally apply to the scientific evidence that suggests what happened to the Etruscans. After a succession of military defeats more than 2,000 years ago left them overtaken by the Romans. This lecture is about endings and about beginnings as well. After the Roman Empire itself fell, continuing on into the Dark Ages and the medieval period, there's not much evidence for any Etruscan cultural continuity. But in the 14th century, something astonishing happened. Italian culture, native Italian culture, began to reassert itself. And with that came a renewed interest in fact, a celebration of, Roman culture. We, of course, call this the Renaissance. Unbeknownst to most of those championing Roman culture, they were, as we now realize, actually celebrating many aspects of Etruscan culture. Some scholars recognized this Etruscan influence for what it was, although mostly much later, after reflecting back on the Renaissance. Among these was John Ruskin, the influential 19th century British art historian who traveled throughout Italy and lived in Venice for extended periods. Writing about all the key figures of the Italian early Renaissance, Ruskin concluded that the 14th century Italian Renaissance painter Giotto was a pure Etruscan Greek, converted indeed to worship Saint Francis instead of Heracles. In adding a number of great Italian artists to his argument, among them Ghiberti, Donatello, Frangelico, and Botticelli, Ruskin contended that they all made works which were absolutely pure Etruscan, merely changing subjects. Well, without belaboring the point, I'll offer two bronze sculptures, another in marble, and a fresco painting in support of Ruskin's assertion. The influence of bronze sculpture, one of the Etruscan specialties, can be traced to the initial discovery in 1553 of the famous and dynamic Chimera sculpture. Uncovered during excavations just outside the walls of the town of Arezzo, it was claimed immediately by Cosimo de' Medici, who called himself the Duke of Etruria. The bronze was restored and placed on display in Florence at the Palazzo Vecchio, Cosimo's residence in the city. It was later studied and restored by the artist Benvenuto Cellini and seen by Giorgio Vasari, himself from Arezzo, who left an account of its discovery, saying, "In our time, that is, in 1554, when trenches, fortifications, and ramparts are being made at Arezzo, there was found a bronze sculpture made as the Chimera. In this sculpture, one can recognize the perfecting of that art, which took place in antiquity among the Etruscans. And this sculpture, because of its beauty and antiquity, has been placed by Duke Cosimo in the hall of the new rooms of his palace." Western civilization had lost, and not yet recovered, the ability to read the Etruscan inscription that proved the Chimera to be a votive dedication to the deity Tin. But stylistically, it was instantly known to be Etruscan. That display and the celebration of it in print led to a renaissance in bronze casting in 15th century Tuscany. Cosimo himself commissioned a bronze portrait bust from Cellini based on the twin Etruscan practices of bronze work and portraiture. the restored chimera, as impressive as it was, wasn't alone in inspiring the Renaissance bronze industry. For example, a 16th century excavation outside of Florence yielded over 500 bronze statuettes in just a few days. The popularity of the divine Greek hero Hercules among the Etruscans meant that many of these bronze statuettes were votive dedications to him. This resulted in an explosion of Hercules bronze statuettes in 15th and 16th century Tuscan art. Hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of these Etruscan-inspired works can still be found in museums and galleries even today. These small-scale bronze works were the most numerous of the Etruscan-inspired products, but some patrons wanted larger-scale works, and artists were more than happy to oblige them. Donatello's bronze David, with its slender proportions, contrapposto stance, and nudity as a mark of a hero, shares all three of these elements with ancient Etruscan bronzes. Two of the most impressive of these are displayed outdoors in Florence today: 16th century sculptures of Hercules and the centaur Nessus and Hercules and Cacus. We might add to them the 16th century Fountain of Neptune, also in Florence, essentially a figure with Hercules' body and Cosimo de' Medici's features. It really doesn't get any more Renaissance than that. Well, Hercules was always popular and influential, but so were the images of ordinary Etruscans that Renaissance artists saw in tomb paintings and sculptures. And the high quality of Etruscan art was recognized, not only its availability. Lorenzo Ghiberti, a sculptor of the doors on the Baptistry of Florence, which were called by Michelangelo the Gates of Paradise, observed, "I believe that, at that time more than any other, the art of painting flourished in Etruria, and even more importantly than it ever did in Greece." One of the best documented and common artistic motifs the Renaissance artists took from Etruscan examples was the reclining figure. Found with frequency in tomb paintings and on the lids of cinerary urns, reclining diners were almost ubiquitous in Etruscan art. And the reclining figure was, to use the economic term, fungible. That is, capable of being placed in, for example, a Christian work where it can become the Virgin Mary, or to be repurposed as Noah on the Sistine Chapel ceiling, or one of Michelangelo's personifications on his tomb commissions. Some Etruscan symbols of government, such as the fasces, the bundle of rods and an axe that symbolized the supreme authority in the state, reemerged during the Renaissance, and again during the Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century, and in the nationalist periods in Italy after its unification in 1871. My favorite example of later appropriation of the fasces is found in the attempt by Cola di Rienzo in 14th century Rome to overthrow the papal rulers of the city and reestablish the Republic, bolstered by these powerful symbols of Roman government. His efforts failed, but it was a remarkable testament to the long-standing influence of these Etruscan public markers of civic service. While interesting, such examples represent a sort of stealth reassertion of Etruscan culture. After all, promulgating them didn't actually associate the symbols, forms of government, and so on with the Etruscans. So let's look instead at the influence of the Etruscans specifically attributed to them. One of the most interesting spheres for this is in the decorative arts. Now, visit any decent art or archaeology museum in Europe or North America, and you'll very likely come across cases of vases. I live in a town of 60,000 people in the Midwest, and even we have one of these in our local museum. Most such vases are of the type art historians refer to as red or black figure. I'm sure you'd recognize them. They feature black backgrounds with orange figures, or the reverse, with an orange background and black figures. Most are painted with large-scale figures from Greek myth. Thousands of these survive from antiquity, and more are found every year. We now know that they were made and decorated in Athens, and based on their popularity, were exported across the ancient world, eventually inspiring local workshops in many other regions that copied them as well. The best and most intact examples of these were first discovered in large numbers excavated from Etruscan tombs. Beginning particularly during the 18th century, European tourists flooding Italy created a market for these. One of the most famous and influential of these collectors was Sir William Hamilton, British ambassador to the Kingdom of Naples from 1764 to 1800. Hamilton collected large numbers of black and red figure vases and published volumes of catalogs of his collection, making collecting even more fashionable. He sold one installment to the British Museum for £8,400, the equivalent today of about $1.5 million. So, when first found, the common belief was that these black and red figure vases represented Etruscan art rather than Etruscan taste and import patterns. And they were published as Etruscan through much of the 18th century until it was finally proven and accepted that they were Greek. By that time, however, a craze for these had swept Western Europe. Interest was particularly intense in England after the acquisition and display of the Hamilton collection in the British Museum. What followed was the vast new popularity of Etruscan fashion design and interiors. People wanted not only to collect these antiquarian vases, but to live surrounded by their designs. It's as though they thought, how could I turn a vase inside out and live in it? I used to own a Laura Ashley interior design book with photos of a room decorated by her firm completely in red and black figure designs. It was intense. But Laura Ashley came at the end of the trend, not at the beginning. At the beginning of the trend for Etruscan, or as it was frequently referred to, Etrurian design, were the Adam brothers. These were three 18th century Scottish architects and interior designers, sons of one of the most important architects of the time. The brothers were famous for their carefully and completely designed interiors, which integrated their own version of classical design into every element of a room, from its proportions to lighting, furniture, and wall, floor, and ceiling finishes. One of the most famous works was an Etruscan room. Well, naturally, the Adam brothers worked only for the wealthy aristocrats or the newly wealthy industrial barons in England. But they also published books of engravings so that their designs were spread throughout the English world and could be emulated by those of lower economic status. And they couldn't make all the material for their Etruscan interiors themselves. As a result, other businesses and craft workshops and factories sprang up to fill the demand for this material. Given the Adams' obsessive integration of design, that meant that they created a market for Etruscan light fixtures, furniture, wallpapers, printed leather wall coverings, floorings, and accessories such as replica vases. One of the most thorough expressions of Etruscan design and a truly remarkable example of how it permeated 18th century culture was the founding of a city called Etruria in Staffordshire, England. As the brainchild of Josiah Wedgwood, the famous pottery manufacturer, the city became the location for his new factory. Inspired by the Hamilton collections, Josiah Wedgwood founded Etruria in 1769 and placed the new factory, appropriately called Etruria Works, at the site. His house, Etruria Hall, was nearby. Wedgwood's motto for this enterprise was Artes Etruriae Renascuntur. Latin, sadly not Etruscan, for Etruscan Arts Reborn. The irony, of course, is that much of what was produced copied Greek, not Etruscan objects, including the very impressively accurate copies of red figure vases with the Latin, not Etruscan motto painted on them prominently. Not that this was at all a purely English expression of admiration. The Adam style, as it has come to be known, was also popular in the British colonies, especially in North America. There, it developed into what we now call federal style, a design popular during the American Revolution and the founding of the United States federal government. With all due respect for the Adam brothers, one of the finest examples of the style was in Germany, where the Etruscan style also inspired architects and interior designers. One example is the Etruscan room of the kings of Prussia, designed and created in their winter palace at Potsdam. This Etruscan room in the 17th century palace was renovated in 1802 by Friedrich Gottlieb Schadow under King Friedrich Wilhelm III. Copies of Etruscan vases as well as complementary furniture filled a room whose walls were also covered with Etruscan designs, all of which was unfortunately destroyed in World War II. While returning to Italy, it's possible to trace a remarkable amount of cultural continuity from the Etruscans right up to the present day. To cite but one of perhaps a countless number of examples, the terracotta tiles on roofs across Tuscany are interchangeable with those found on the 6th century BC Etruscan buildings at Merlo. If you'll add to these Etruscan masonry techniques, stone paving of streets and piazzas, and the shape and proportions of doors and windows, then the extent of continuity in the material world of the modern inhabitants of Tuscany with their ancient counterparts is inarguable. Perhaps that makes sense from a strictly practical standpoint. If something works, if it's what one is familiar with and sees throughout the community, copying or extending it makes sense, even in areas that are symbolically important, such as religion. It's been noted that the Kreuzer, the pastoral staff of the Catholic bishop, bears a remarkable resemblance to the Lituus, the crooked wand with a curved top of the Etruscan auger. Such continuities are not the case even in other regions of Italy. In Campania, to take one example, where waves of invasion and colonization are well documented, we can't look at the building forms from, say, Pompeii and cite such a range of parallels in modern communities. So how to account for the seemingly remarkable continuity in Tuscany? Well, one model would be conscious emulation. The pride of regional identity leads to the conscious replication of admired forms and behaviors. Rather like Etruria Staffordshire with its Etruscan art, this would be a completely artificial cultural relationship. That might be the case in Tuscany, but the banality of some of the cultural markers, such as roof tiles and paving stones, seems to argue against a cultural renaissance celebrating the great qualities of the Etruscans. The question about continuity has been raised pretty much ever since people rediscovered the Etruscans. But only in this century are we in a position to answer this question, as well as larger ones, about where the Etruscans went after Roman occupation, and the most vexing question of all, where they came from. With respect to where to and where from, the answers seem to be nowhere. That is, the Etruscans didn't go anywhere, and they didn't come from anywhere. They seem to have gotten their start in the area that we call Tuscany, and most remarkably, to still be there. We have modern genetics to thank for these conclusions. A few decades ago, a special issue of the journal Etruscan Studies published 8 papers on the question I just laid out for you, on the questions I just laid out for you. 2 of the papers were cultural or anthropological attempts to answer the questions by defining Etruscan culture or populations. The conclusions of each paper were inconclusive. The 6 other papers were scientific examinations that used DNA analysis to try to identify the ethnic makeup of the Etruscans, and therefore their origins and their relationships to other peoples in Tuscany, Italy, and Europe. In these papers, scientists used mitochondrial DNA to look for genetic variations that would indicate related populations. Determining degrees of genetic variation might reveal common markers shared by select populations in Europe or the Mediterranean. The results, for me at least, were disappointing. And the conclusions that the available genetic evidence could not distinguish Etruscan identity, arrival, or development were nothing short of frustrating. As one of the papers concluded, a direct proof of the continuity between the original Etruscan people and some selected groups of individuals living today in Tuscany is not feasible. However, other more recent studies have attempted to answer the same questions using different evidence, and very cleverly in the example of the DNA of cattle. One of these studies found that almost 60% of the mitochondrial DNA in modern cows in the central Tuscan region of the country, where the Etruscan civilization is thought to have arisen, was the same as that in cows from Anatolia, modern Turkey, and the Middle East. This conclusion was reported in the press, especially the Turkish press, as supporting the Greek historian Herodotus' account of Etruscan immigration from Lydia as being correct. Do you see the problem with this? The researchers didn't conclude anything at all about the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. What they had performed was a fascinating study of modern cow DNA that said absolutely nothing about ancient Italy. They used no ancient material from Tuscany or Turkey, but then announced that their conclusions should be applied to answer questions about the ancient world. There's no reason to assume that modern cows in Italy have any relationship to ancient ones. Rather, given the dramatic differences in life expectancy and life cycle between ancient and modern cattle, I'm dubious that even if a genetic connection could be made, saying that it must also apply to ancient humans in Italy requires a leap that seems unsupported by the evidence. Fortunately, science doesn't stop, and techniques to study DNA continue to improve. And a more recent, thorough, and larger study came to very different conclusions. This one extracted and typed the hypervariable region of mitochondrial DNA of 14 individuals buried in 2 Etruscan necropolis and analyzed them, along with other Etruscan and medieval samples and 4,910 contemporary individuals from the Mediterranean basin. Let me point out that the relatively small sample size of Etruscans is the unfortunate result of the widespread Etruscan habit of cremation. There just aren't that many Etruscan bones left to work with. Well, in comparing 30 ancient Etruscans and 27 medieval individuals to the modern DNA sequences of 370 Tuscans, and testing that analysis with millions of computer simulations, these more recent scholars reached their conclusions. So to recap, this study by Giroto, Tassi, Fumagalli, Colonna, and Sandianigi compared ancient and modern material and tested a control group from the wider Mediterranean as well as in Italy itself. Well, what about those conclusions? In the researchers' words, the Etruscans can be considered ancestral with a high degree of confidence to the current inhabitants of Casentino and Volterra. There it is, a definite, scientifically based conclusion of continuity between ancient and modern populations in two Etruscan communities. The researchers were admirably cautious about applying their conclusions more broadly, and so only postulated these two local connections. Nevertheless, despite the limited nature of the work, it's the largest and most positive study to date on Etruscan population, and answers the question of where the Etruscans went after occupation. As far as we can tell, nowhere. They were and are still where they've always been, at least since the 8th century BC. That goes a long way towards explaining the cultural continuities found in Tuscany. It also suggests the model of Roman civilization in ancient Etruria, or central Italy, as a veneer laid over the ancient traditional culture. I'm reminded of that line in The Lord of the Rings about the nature of the bucolic Shire. Tolkien wrote, "And so life in the Shire goes on, very much as it has this past age, full of its own comings and goings, with change coming slowly, if it comes at all." I've always thought there was a lot of wisdom in that line, and an awareness that no matter who rules the city, life in the country doesn't change all that much. Well, how does this study account for its conclusions contrary to previous work? As the authors state, "What previous studies overlooked is the potential genetic effect of population subdivision. If most Etruscans' descendants lived in isolated communities in the last 2,000 years, their DNAs may still persist in some localities, but will escape detection unless they're sought at the appropriate, i.e., smaller, geographical scale." In other words, to find the Etruscans, they had to search through the small communities for them, with an awareness that genetic markers can differ from as close as 10 kilometers away. Not a surprise to anyone who has lived even a short time in rural Italy and noticed that local populations tend towards endogamy, marriage within the group, as opposed to exogamy, marriage outside the group. That's all very interesting, but it doesn't address the big question, Etruscan origins. Can genetics take another crack at the Herodotus versus Dionysius of Halicarnassus debate of Etruscan origins as immigrants versus indigenous people? Yes. Yes, it can. Once again, let's hear from the scientists themselves. By further considering two Anatolian samples, 35 and 123 individuals, we could estimate that the genetic links between Tuscany and Anatolia date back to at least 5,000 years ago, strongly suggesting that the Etruscan culture developed locally and not as an immediate consequence of immigration from the eastern Mediterranean shores. That is stated as a pretty definitive conclusion, and I have to say it's a great deal more persuasive to me than cattle DNA. It also provides a useful reminder that we need to treat ancient literary sources with a great deal of skepticism. Herodotus is not, after all, a contemporary source on the origin, no more than I am of the American Revolution. It's a further reminder not to believe everything that we learn in Roman sources. We shouldn't be shocked to learn that the reported Roman massacre of the entire population of Volterra must have been exaggerated if it happened at all. It would hardly be the first time that Roman history was adjusted for propaganda purposes. Well, at the end of a lecture, a chapter, or a book, I like to ask myself, what's the takeaway? What's the conclusion or the big revelation? I'd love to be able to say that after this lecture, indeed this entire course, you should leave with the conclusion that it's the Etruscans' world and we're just living in it. I'd love to, but I can't. There's too much missing that we don't know. But that model I presented earlier of an Etruscan culture continuing under Roman occupation, much as it had for centuries, well, I think that's our lesson. That under our culture, even under the Roman culture, which so much of ours is so self-consciously based on, there's another, older, deeper culture. And that's where we'll find the Etruscans. The next time you pass a restaurant and see couples dining together, or when you drive down an east-west street, passing blocks defined by other streets that run strictly north-south, I'd like you to think of the Etruscans, the first people in Europe to create a society with those organizing elements. There are, of course, countless other examples of cultural descent linking us back to the Etruscans, and I'm not going to begin to name them. I'm sure that by now, if you've made it through these lectures and not just skipped to the end, you'll be able to name some of them as well as I can, maybe better. Knowing that such connections exist should encourage us to more closely examine our world, as well as our lives, with their patterns and symbols, and see that they represent an accumulation, really an agglutinative pattern of cultural identities and values, added and taken away over the centuries and millennia. All of which is not to say that our culture isn't unique, or to make it seem as though I feel it's somehow less important. On the contrary, such cumulative layers connect us to the mysterious Etruscans, a people who lived more than 2 millennia ago. Recognizing and understanding this underscores our responsibility as caretakers, taking what we've been given and consciously passing it on to those who come after us.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.